I'm Marge Pryor, and welcome to my series of podcasts based on the oral history interviews I did for my book, Shooting at the Moon, which documented the UN peace process in Cambodia during 1993. In this episode, you will hear from the Australian lawyers who tried to introduce a rule of law to a lawless country that had evolved its own complex legal systems based on tradition, culture, and fear. As part of the peace agreements, 20 UN human rights officers were appointed to deliver human rights training, monitor and investigate human rights complaints, and establish an independent judiciary for the new government. The worst breaches of human rights in Cambodia were the summary executions by the military and police of suspected criminal and political offenders. There was an overwhelming presumption that a person taken into custody was guilty, spending years in prison without a trial. To curb the high level of political violence, UNTAC gave the power of arrest to the UN military and civilian police and created the Office of Special Prosecutor to prosecute cases before the Cambodian courts. Australian barrister Mark Plunkett was appointed to the position of Special Prosecutor and soon found himself powerless when trying to prosecute two serious offences. The first was a SOC policeman accused of shooting a royalist politician in front of his family, then chasing his wife and child across a paddy field, shooting and throwing hand grenades after them. The second was a Khmer Rouge soldier who confessed to his involvement in the killing of 15 people on the Tonle Sap River the previous year. When Mark Plunkett tried to bring these cases before the Cambodian courts, the judges wouldn't hear them in fear of their own safety. He then tried to bring in international jurists to sit with the Khmer judges. But this was criticised and overruled by the UN as an intrusion on the sovereignty of Cambodia, and his efforts failed.
So part of this process of peace, from war to peace transition, inevitably means a civilianisation of power. And rather than a direct line of command based on military discipline, it means that justice and equity requires an independent person, free of any orders or instructions, makes a decision. Now, under the new Cambodian criminal law, Article 1 so provides that a judge is independent of any executive or legislative body and any political party. Now, there's been no culture of an independent judiciary here. There's been no legal tradition. It's usually been the party imposing its will upon the state, in a one-party state where the party and the state are the same thing. And you have political directives operating the power of the state. And the courts here, the courthouses themselves physically just barnyards and places where they put their cars. They do have a sort of a judicial process because any community demands the resolution of disputes, for example, matrimonial disputes. And so that people require an independent arbiter for that, someone they can have confidence in to dissolve a marriage, so that the family situation here is conducted very efficiently as a judicial system, family law. Because the state really hasn't got an interest in suppressing one party to a marriage or dissolution of a marriage against another. I mean, that's a genuine dispute between two citizens. I'm not too sure to what extent the civil courts operate that way. I don't think they do, but certainly there's been no functioning criminal courts. They bring people before a court and they're usually found guilty, is alleged on their own confessions by the police, and they're dealt with that way. So there's been no functioning independence of the court, particularly where the state has been accused of wrongdoing. So what UNTAC is involved in at the moment is establishing the Office of Special Prosecutor by directive of Mr. Akashi to investigate only those crimes and to prosecute only those crimes which have a human rights breach. For example, the murder of party officials because they express a view which some other people find unpalatable. Inevitably, that may mean that the Special Prosecutor's Office will cause to be arrested and prosecuted officials of existing administrative structures. Now, this is something so foreign to them. that they've been brought to account for misconduct, that they can't handle it. Is that they're outraged that we would arrest and prosecute people and bring them before a court to have them tried if those people are members of the existing administrative structure. Now, the Special Prosecutor's Office has been established specifically with that charter and to look at crimes which involve officials and police and so forth, because it is being alleged by victims that it is officialdom that is carrying out these acts of terrorism, that it is police of a particular administrative structure, an army of a particular administrative structure, persecuting members of political parties opposite to what the government is or what the existing administrative structure is. So there's been a lot of allegations that many of these crimes are being committed by the state itself.
Lawyer Bruce Henry's role was to monitor conditions in the prisons. The collapse of the legal system meant very few prisoners were convicted of any crime, with some being held for more than 10 years without trial.
In the municipal police prison, the Phnom Penh Municipal Police Prison, which is called PJ Prison, it's a prison that's built for 20 to 30 inmates. At the time when we came here, there were 180 prisoners in it, and their conditions were disgraceful. There were a large number of people who were too sick to even sit up, let alone stand. They couldn't, not all of the prisoners could lie down at the one time in the prison because it was so crowded. So they couldn't all sleep at the one time. Some of them had to stand while the others lay down. There were all manner of diseases in the place, from beriberi through to typhoid and cholera. And in those sorts of cramped conditions, you can imagine how quickly those diseases would spread. People were dying from diseases that they caught in the prisons or from starvation through lack of food in the prisons. So the health conditions were very, very bad. In the National Security Prison, T3, and in almost every police cell and prison throughout the country, they were using shackles at that time, which are leg irons that are attached to the ankles so that the prisoner, when they're in the shackles, can only sit up. They can lie down with difficulty because they can't really straighten their legs out completely, and they can't stand, so they spend most of their time just sitting. We found some prisoners who'd been in those sorts of shackles for 4 or 5 months without being released. That was the extreme case, but the common situation was for prisoners to be shackled for about 20, 21 hours a day and allowed to walk around for 3 or 4 hours. That was fairly common. And in the main prison, T3, and the main provincial prisons, that was the standard practice.
Is there any torture? Does that go on?
There have been isolated reports of torture, but certainly not on a widespread basis. I think that's one area where they do differ from some former regimes, perhaps. Torture is not widespread in the prisons, unless you count sheer neglect as torture. And, you know, it's possible to argue that the sort of neglect that we saw and that we do see still in some of the prisons does constitute torture. Things such as giving prisoners so little food that they starve to death, I mean, that can clearly be seen as a form of torture. So, but we have had isolated reports of quite extreme forms of torture from some of the provinces.
The cooperation has stopped. Why? Why did this happen?
Well, the sort of general refrain that we get from the SOC authorities in September is that UNTAC should be out dealing with the problems that Pol Pot is causing rather than focusing on them. And particularly the human rights component should be worrying about Pol Pot and not worrying about them. So they say that given the problems that Pol Pot has caused and is continuing to cause, the things that are going on in their prisons, for example, are a very minor matter and are not even worthy of consideration or discussion. So they're not interested in discussing them with us. Well, it's frustrating, particularly to see the prisons going back to what they were before, and to see the prisoners getting sicker and sicker and being held in, you know, prisoners that you see every week, and we've been visiting every week for 6 months or more, who were starting to improve, and to see their health deteriorating again is very frustrating. All of the prisoners in the two major Phnom Penh prisons now are awaiting trial. There's another prison outside Phnom Penh called Prey Sar, which holds the convicted prisoners. And some of the other convicted prisoners are held in other places. But the two main Phnom Penh prisons have about 250 people in them, none of whom have had a trial. And some of those have been held for 10 years or more.
What about their families?
Their families are allowed, in theory, to visit them once a month. We've had a lot of complaints from people that they're not allowed to see relatives unless they pay, that food that they bring in for their relatives is not allowed to go to the relatives but is taken by the guards, for example. Those are very common complaints. And one of the other practices that has concerned us for since we came here and that we've been negotiating with them about for some months is that they tend to transfer prisoners from province to province or from the provinces to Phnom Penh when the effect of that is to take them completely away from their families and their home area so that they receive no visits from anyone. That's a very good way to break down a prisoner's relationships with the society as well as with their families. So it makes it more difficult for the prisoners when they're released if they have to go and attempt to find their families again and try to find out what's happened to their families over the preceding years.
What are the prisoners like when you go into these jails with your interpreter and you talk to them?
I guess the first thing that you notice about them is that they're not very lively. If you go into prisons in Australia, for example, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of activity in the prisons. Going into prisons here, the first thing you notice is that people are really not healthy enough to be active, if you like. In some of the prisons, the overcrowding is a contributing factor to that too. But in the prisons here, their health is such and the heat is such that mostly all the prisoners can do is sit, and they don't make a lot of noise, they don't move around very much because they're not well enough to do that. So when we go in, we're received fairly well, I suppose. They're always pleased that we're there. I think it gives them some sort of line to the outside world that they appreciate. But there's no sort of boisterous exuberance or anything like that. We did take them at Christmas time. We took in some food to the PJ prison, which is the worst. We took in, took up a collection in the office, and we took a whole lot of food into them to try and we said to them, you know, Christmas is a feast in our country, so we'd like, and we share food with each other at that time, so we'd like to do that with you at Christmas. And they were very excited about that. And that was the first decent meal many of them had for a long time as well. First time they'd seen any fruit or anything like that. So, we visit them very regularly. They know who we are. They also, I think, are coming to realise that we're not necessarily the answer to all of their problems, though. While they're pleased to see us, they don't really expect too much of us anymore, I suppose.
What about the future? How do you see things changing?
Well, if the SOC authorities don't change their attitude, I don't know that things are going to change very much for the better. I think that with the level of cooperation we have at the moment, the best we can hope to do is to maintain a sort of holding operation, I suppose, to try and stop the conditions from getting any worse, which is what we try to concentrate on at the moment. I suppose, to be fair to SOC, one thing I should say too is that they are the only faction who've even allowed us into their prisons. So, you know, it's easy to be critical of them, and we are, but we also have to temper that with the comment that the other factions have refused any access to any detention facilities that they hold. And in fact, all of them have, their response to us is that they have no prisons and they have no prisoners, which of course can't be. It either isn't true, or it means that they're dealing with people who commit crimes in some other way, which is a cause for concern in itself.
Human rights trainers Peter Condliffe and Brett Mason ran courses for police in the liberated zone and in the state of Cambodia. It provided challenges for the trainers, who came to realise that they could not divorce human rights from the social context of traditional law and a complex legal system that had evolved from years of isolation.
The main issue is for us as educators is the apparent lack of training that these people have had. The SOC police that we've dealt with have been in the police service for most of them since 1979, 1980, after the overthrow of the Khmer Rouge regime. But during that time, their training has been obviously quite minimal. And the police here have essentially usurped the functions of the judicial system. So the judiciary here essentially is seems quite powerless, and the police play the role of judge, jury and executioner. That raises another issue, and something that I've been quite surprised about is that there's a persistence here, very much the persistence of a traditional legal system, where most disputes or conflict, including those involving what we would regard as criminal offences, are resolved in traditional ways, and that's usually through means of mediation, compromise, and through the payment of compensation. Probably the best story I've heard about that is the case of a witch in a village who there'd been several deaths in the village, and this witch was thought to have caused the death. And the families of the people who had died agreed that they would kill this witch. And they approached the village headman, and he agreed also. So they killed her, and then it was arranged with the families of the witch, her family, that the way to resolve the ensuing conflict or potential conflict between the families involved was to pay compensation. So the headman then played the role of mediator. And this is a very typical story. It indicates, and the police that we were talking to about this thought this was quite a reasonable way to proceed. And in some ways it is, because trying to adjudicate in that sort of issue where there's no effective judiciary would be quite difficult. And to a Cambodian, the outcome was a good one. The witch was dead, the evil was dealt with, and everybody was compensated. We find that system quite abhorrent. But in this sort of society, it makes some sort of sense. The other thing is that it indicates the superstitious nature of many of the beliefs here still, and I suppose related to those issues is that we can't divorce the concept of human rights from a social context, and in some ways, our Western concepts of human rights don't quite fit in here at the moment. I've been thinking that also that this society has essentially been cut off from the world in many ways for 10, 15 years. And during that time, it's developed its own solutions, often in isolation from outside currents. So there's some of the things that occur to me as we're teaching them. The other here, just at the conceptual level, the theoretical plane, you've actually got to relate it to their practice in this society, and that means number of things. One, you've got to listen to their stories and relate some of the ideals to the actual practice of policing in this society. So you've got to talk about due process in a Cambodian context, or how you'd run a trial in a Cambodian context, or what the transitional criminal provisions that exist in Cambodia at the moment, how they work in this context. You talk about freedom of expression or any of the civil rights, you've got to actually put it in the context in which they're working. So that means you've actually got to engage them from their experience, and that's really guided our process. So we only lecture 2 out of about 6 or 7 hours a day that we teach, and the rest is small group work, discussions, question and answer, simulations, listening to them, talking to them about their issues and their practice, that sort of thing. So I think that's really important.
Yeah. I was just thinking, based on their experiences with the witch, for example, in a human rights context, you'd find that quite difficult to incorporate, wouldn't you? Because they're working through superstitions and...
That's right. And it doesn't... I suppose, in a sense, in the West, what we do is we reduce everything to formulas, and we reduce them to abstracts, formulas, which we can nicely then pigeonhole into a fairly clean, precise, formal process of the law. There's no nice, clean, formal process. We can't reduce things to such simplicities. The Cambodians, like any informal legal system, runs at a very complex level. And there's all sorts of social relationships that are going on at a level which we pretend doesn't exist in Western culture. It still exists, but we pretend it doesn't, because we've got this highly developed and sophisticated legal system which, while it formalises everything, it actually reduces it to its simplest, you know, common denominator. And that doesn't... the customary and the traditional is still in the ascendant here in many ways. And it's a very complex and rich background against which to try and teach human rights. So if we come in and say, these are the covenants, these are the international treaties, this is what it means at this fairly complex level, it makes no sense at all to these people.
But that must create dilemmas for you, because in a traditional Aboriginal culture, they have a very well-developed legal system that works for them. And in what you're really saying is that the Cambodian culture also has similar ways of handling things.
It might be difficult for us, but I think the contradictions are much more painful to the Cambodians and the Aboriginals, because they're the people actually experiencing the clash of cultures. They're the people who are actually experiencing the invasion of foreign cultures, whether it be the Americans, the Russians, the Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Thais, and now UNTAC. They're the people who are actually suffering the contradictions, not us. We can come here and feel some sort of sense of outrage or so on, but they're the people who are actually dying and suffering. And they're the people who are actually paying the price. So, yeah, it's sort of, it's too simple to say, well, that's terrible, because it doesn't answer anything. So, yeah, so I think one's got to sort of pay heed to the stories. I've got to pay heed to the practice. I've got to pay heed to the experience of your students. And Brett and I are constantly saying to these students, we respect your views. We respect you as students, as police officers. I think that's really important.
Despite the challenges and the frustration he experienced as a UN Special Prosecutor, Mark Plunkett believes the human rights effort was not in vain.
In hindsight, I think that we were on the road to achieving things. I mean, there are two models that I understand it about the re-establishment of the rule of law post-conflict. And one is, I suppose, an institutional model of setting up courts, which usually have to be accompanied by having a cadre of lawyers and judges, law libraries, and inevitably for offenders where imprisonment is the last resort, in prisons. We did work on that. The other model is a negotiated community model, which I saw the Australian Federal Police implement rather successfully in the liberated zone, which simply meant going around talking to people, calming down disputes, and giving ordinary people the idea that they have to be responsible, or someone has to be responsible, for wrongdoing. So one of the big problems in a post-conflict setting where force has been the only mechanism to resolve conflicts is that you soon have emerging a culture of impunity, so that people think they can do what they like, whether they be official military officers, police, or warlords. So the idea of slowing, in our case in Cambodia, after 30 years, slowing that down is a very hard task. But I think the two models, a negotiated model or a community policing model, together with an institutional creational model, were effectively on the road in Cambodia. So in the very short time we had, I think we did achieve a lot in commencing that progress against the background of the primary mission, which was to have an election for a constituent democratic assembly. So the rule of law aspect is a critical part of any peacekeeping mission, perhaps even more critically than creating a democratic institution to run the country. So there's no use having a democracy unless you have rule of law. They go hand in glove. So our mission, as it evolved, saw that as a critical thing to do, hence the creation of the Special Office of Prosecutor and commencing prosecutions. So we did investigate serious crimes, all of which at a very high level, which were a threat to the democratic election process, like attacking political parties, murdering political opponents, kidnapping, and so forth. And we did put together good prosecution briefs. We did go to the courts and get their approval to arrest people. We did create a prison which met UN standards, and we did imprison held offenders subject to prosecutions. But the process broke down because there were no UN courts. We had to use the local courts. And, of course, the local courts, by their nature, couldn't be seen as being impartial and unbiased, because the appointed judges were appointed by the various factions. The Khmer Rouge had a completely different approach to dealing with crimes, to the extent that they may have had community participation and critical appraisals, when I say distinct to just summary executions. And similarly for the other faction, major faction, CAPAF, their courts weren't really composed of genuine jurists. So the system was bound to break down once we started to get prosecutions underway, because the judge had told me that they weren't going to conduct the trials that the UN were bringing because it wasn't safe for them or even for us, as they articulated it. So at that point, without a court to prosecute our cases, the system broke down. But nevertheless, in the background, we were working to get international judges with UN approval to constitute international courts to conduct the prosecutions that the UN is endeavouring to advance. But our time was too short. We were to leave after the election in May. So there was insufficient time to see that through. So I don't see it as a failure at all. I see it as a success, because after the UNTAC mission, the notion that there should be justices packages was endorsed by the Millennium Program by the UN in peace operations, and it was a critical part of other peace missions that followed, including East Timor, Bougainville, and the Solomons, of which Australia was a critical player. But one critical achievement is that for at least 10 decades, armies and warlords have marched across the rice fields and through the villages of ordinary Khmer. UNTAC preserved the boundaries of Cambodia as defined by the surrounding nations in the Westphalian sense, and brought to an end of the mass intrusion of foreign armies and warlords. So for all our failures, looking back after 30 years, and having regard to the short time that we're there, I think the international community can be proud of some of its achievements, and that in particular. particularly when you look at the wars that have followed since 9/11, 20 years in Afghanistan, $1 trillion. So people used to complain that UNTAC was expensive. Well, it looks remarkably cheap, and we only had 18 months to do the things that we could do. And we brought about the result of bringing a peace to the Khmer people and a better quality of life to the Khmer people. Of course, they would say that we installed one of the world's longest dictatorships. But given the resources that we had and time being the scarcest of all, I think the international community and the UN and Australia in particular would be proud of the lasting legacies of that peacekeeping operation.
This is Marge Pryor, author and publisher of Shooting at the Moon. Next episode, I'll bring you the story of a young Aussie bridge builder who managed the construction of a series of bridges along Route 5 that opened up Cambodia's roads for the safe travel of peace workers and the returnees from the Thai border camps.
I had a Khmer engineer with me. We were going back, it was dark, we were stopped, and the guy asked for money. I was sufficiently pissed off and annoyed that he just poked us through the window, stuffed it in my face, and asked me for loy. I said, "Art loy," and I just shoved it out of his road and shoved it back in his own face and told him. My poor little Khmer engineer had hit the floor by this stage and disappeared, and I just drove off. So, but they didn't know. I went and saw them the next day because I was concerned that I'd get, you know, buggerized about by it. And I went on my own. They saw me drive up. I talked to them. And they said that the guy concerned, who put the gun in my face, had a headache and he needed medicine. And I thought, well, fair enough. So I went back to the car and I picked up a big block of paracetamol and I walked over to him. I threw them at him. I said, "Next time you've got a headache, take these. Don't point a gun in my face."
You can go to my website, www.cambodianpeaceworkers.com.au, to listen to these podcasts or purchase my book, Shooting at the Moon. Thank you for listening to my podcast. I'd like to acknowledge the following people who've helped me make them possible. Andrea Close, consultant producer. Tim Roebuck, sound engineer and studio recordist. Aaron Hopper, composer and musician. These podcasts have been produced with the support of the Australian Government.